Welcome to the Gary Gallagher Law Hour. Attorney Gary Gallagher and his firm have represented thousands of Hawaii workers and families during more than 35 years' practice throughout the islands. Whether helping countless workers exposed to asbestos unknowingly in their jobs, filing suit against gas companies for unfair local pricing, or representing the state of Hawaii and winning a settlement against Big Tobacco, the Gallagher Law Firm helps fight for consumer advocacy and fair play for the people of Hawaii. No kopono on your behalf. Now, Gary and his team are here to take the mystery out of what they do and answer your legal questions. So here's the host of our show, Mike Buck, and Hawaii attorney Gary Gallagher.
Aloha and welcome again to our program. We're so glad that you've decided to take an hour and put aside part of your day to catch up with us. And whether you're listening on Saturday or Sunday, we'll be talking about that as time goes on. But we're kind of brand new, and yet we've been around the block a couple times. If you were with us last week, you heard our inaugural show, the Gallagher Law Hour. And many of you probably learned that me, Mike Buck, I'm a host, and yet I know this guy. I've known this guy for a long time, and we have lots and lots of mutual friends, and thank goodness, lots and lots of mutual concerns. So with that, today's program, we're going to tell you a little bit more, not just about Gary the guy, but about the team that is with him, and sort of lawyering 101. I mean, you know, there's any, you go to your primary care physician these days, and he's going to say, whoop, you got to go to the ear guy, you got to go to the throat guy, you got to go to the leg guy. Well, same with the attorney's profession. And Gary, I know that, boy, there's not enough time to tell people how you decided to do what you got to do. But let's go back. Let's go back to when you first started as an attorney. What cases you thought you might like to follow?
Well, I worked with a great law firm, Shim Siegel Tam and Naito, and was trained under Ray Tam and Walter Kiramitsu, so I had excellent beginnings. And we represented injured workers primarily, but there were also consumers. And the first asbestos case was a mesothelioma case, Tristan Obriga, who was an electrician at Pearl Harbor Naval Shipyard.
And was that the eye-opener, Gary, when you thought, oh my goodness, I can't believe how big of a problem nationally and internationally this is?
Well, it was like the camel's nose into the tent.
Yeah.
It was the beginning. And then once you see it, it's hard to believe that an industrial disease could be that devastating and have those numbers. There's 3,000 mesothelioma cases diagnosed every year. Yep. And the tragic part of it is there's so many uses. Johns Manville was had a Vertica monopoly.
Yeah, who were those guys? John, for those that don't know, what is Johns Manville?
They were, from the turn of the century, they mined and milled, manufactured asbestos products, and had mines in Canada and imported asbestos from around the world, South Africa, Russia, Bolivia, wherever they could get the best prices. And asbestos is mined out of the ground. And rather than just turn into dust when you crumble it up, it turns into tiny little fibers when you look at it under the microscope. And it's not the ones you can see floating around the air like dust or lint. It's the microscopic ones that cause the real problem.
Interesting, because, you know, I know a lot about bee pollen because of my Nature Bee guys in New Zealand. And there's a couple of kinds of pollen, one that floats around in the air and one that falls to the ground. The one that falls to the ground is good for you. The one that floats in the air gets you sick. So there must have been some reasons why... somebody discovered this in the very beginning. What did your initial Niele, the Gary Gallagher that wants to know all about this stuff, what did you find out when it was first discovered and what its use was in the very beginning?
Well, it was used after it was mined out of the ground. Originally, they got long fibers out of it, and they wove it, and they made cloth, and made fireproof things. And the cloth was woven into a textile. And the textile was incorporated into things such as brakes.
Yeah.
Brakes since in the 1920s had asbestos.
Sure. Yeah.
And insulation around pipes and things like that since the turn of the century, and gaskets and packing. And Johns Manville was very ingenious in that they figured out ways to use asbestos in more than 3,000 products.
Isn't it amazing? I mean, today we hear about stuff like bamboo. You know, there's bamboo. You can have bamboo shirts or bamboo floors or bamboo anything in between. So in the very beginning, it must have been a race for more uses. In other words, these guys kept cranking out new ways to use this material.
Exactly. Unfortunately, people who were putting it in the bags were getting sick, and Manville and Revestis Manhattan, those companies didn't bother to tell anybody. Mm-hmm. But the long and short of it is the disease or diseases have a long latency, meaning you can be exposed now, but it takes 20, 30, 40, 50 years to get the disease. So they started using the products, and it just escalated during World War II. And then the inevitable sequelae, the diseases, mm-hmm. came 20, 30 years later.
I don't think anybody at that time, and I want to go back in time because right away we jumped right into that, that made, when somebody has an issue and they say, you know, somebody tells them, family member, friend, co-worker, say, you know, you really ought to talk to a lawyer, man. There's something wrong with this. There's different kinds of law, and you know, we all see there's trial lawyers for this, there's defense lawyers, there's insurance guys, there's fraud guys. It seems to me that you chose emotionally the most challenging of all specialties, because you're talking about life and death here, and big, huge companies that have tons of money and little workers that don't.
Well, once we get to the basis of it, I was very lucky at the William S. Richardson School of Law that our law professor there, Dick Miller, actually used asbestos as a subject for one of our courses, social decision making, and how the law was changed and manipulated, and safer standards were tried to be put in, but the industry fought them. So I had some background, but with respect to taking on the companies, that's just what the facts revealed. We didn't have any choice about that. Once we dug into it, there were 30 companies on the other side. I couldn't pick and choose. If they were 30 companies my client worked with, that's the defendant's
case. I was going to ask you that when I first found out about that particular part of your practice, and that is, obviously, there's any number of suppliers of products. So when you go after a bad product, at what point in time does it become traceable? I mean, can you go back to a guy that, say, worked in the shipyard and was using material from a certain company, so therefore the attorneys know what companies to go look for?
That's what we call product identification, and it's a real complex area. And we have 30 years of archives. I can prove what products were on any ship that was home-ported at Pearl Harbor or overhauled at Pearl Harbor, over 200 ships, with respect to the boilers, the turbines, the pumps, the valves. We know what was there.
Wasn't that done very early in your practice with white sheets of paper and carbon paper in between and a little quick thing going type, type, type?
Well, it was almost like that. Yeah. It was almost like that. I think we had the state-of-the-art was Videc or something like that, and then Wang came out. It was pretty primitive.
Well, I think that we talked about this a little bit last time. One of the things that you've done to keep abreast with the changes in the thing is keep bringing young, talented, you know, whiz kids into the practice that can absorb this stuff that you and I probably don't want to deal with too much, but it's part and parcel of your thing. And I must tell you, gang, before you think that we're both dunces, we're texting and we're doing all that stuff, so it's not as though we're ignoring it, right?
No. We have very talented staff, and you know the younger lawyers do. They're just so much more familiar with computer and computer techniques, how to search, how to communicate, so much more efficiently. So we certainly incorporate and utilize their talents.
Here's what happened, gang. Right after we decided to do this show, right off the bat, because Hawaii is a small place and we all know each other and we all depend on each other, I got a call from one of the research folks at Gary's, saying, do you know this guy? Do you know that guy? And it turned out, we're gonna talk about a specific case today and maybe show you a little bit some of the due diligence and some of the stuff that goes on in this practice is just mind-blowing. Because sure enough, I mean, somebody called me, Gary, and said, you know, Mr. Gallagher said that you might know this guy or you might know guys that worked with him. And bingo, I did. And right away, just this door opens up and all of a sudden you find out, hey, I knew that guy, and gee, I didn't know that guy died, and that guy died because he was handling that material. The research part of your business, of your practice is interesting. But what about the people part? I mean, you have to have a big network out there getting leads and talking to people all day.
But it's real interesting. We're lucky we live in Hawaii, and a sense of community, and take care of one another, and if somebody's a father or a husband dies and you are the coworker, and we go ask them, they generally want to just help. Not mm-hmm. not that they're thrilled and delighted to talk to yeah. lawyers. On the other hand, they were there. And, you know, we don't want anybody to just give us anything but the facts and the background. But between their kokua and opening doors, we do even more research and come back. And pretty soon we have catalogs and all kinds of things that refreshes people's memory. I mean, I could ask you right now what you worked with, and you wouldn't remember.
Right.
Whereas if I've got catalogs from that era and you went to them to order your products for your boats, you say, oh, yeah, I remember that. We had that. Exactly. Exactly.
But, so here's what I think is kind of neat. Folks, I've learned a lot. Gary and I have been spending some time off the air as well as on the air on sort of what goes on here. And this particular case became very interesting to me, not only because I know some of the people involved in it, but because I'm thinking, hey, wait a minute, you know, we've all had this thing of when do you know what to do? And I think that you said something funny. Sometimes when you say, well, I'm an attorney, and you see this blank look goes across, you know. There are some... what do you want to call them? Misunderstandings or stereotyping? I mean, you know, some call attorneys ambulance chasers. Some of them call them lifesavers. And what I guess it really matters is, have all of the recent proliferation of law shows on television and all of this stuff, has it informed people a little bit more about what's going on, like the law and orders and all that kind of stuff? Does it help or does it hurt?
I'm not sure about that, because those... Hollywood shows, the best ones, are written so well. They're so dramatic. But they have consulted talented lawyers. Mm-hmm. You can tell they don't go off the rails frequently as to what the law really is.
Gotcha.
So they're smart in that regard. But there's areas of complexity that, you know, lawyers such as myself, I mean, I have to go to other lawyers. I go to lawyers for sure. Wills, trusts, corporation. All that kind of stuff is way beyond mm-hmm. anything one single lawyer could do. It's just... it's kind of like you just can't do it.
And I think, Gary, people have to address it the same way that they address medicine. It used to be the guy in the shopping center near your house had a shingle. He was a doc. You went for him for everything. And sooner or later, when things came out, we need to talk about this, and I'm sure we will in future programs, about malpractice in doctors and all this kind of stuff. All of a sudden, it became more of a specialty field. Some guy really had to know something before he was willing to say, okay, I'm going to work on this patient. And a lot of the stuff that is done by personal injury firms is that kind of stuff, too. How specialized is it? It sounds to me like your profession is extremely specific now.
Oh, yeah. We do products liability cases. They're very complicated, and asbestos is as complicated as anything. It's just treacherous. If you don't know what you're doing, there's real strict time limits. There's real strict procedures. And when someone comes in with one of these diseases, we have to move really fast mm-hmm. because the prognosis is generally not good.
But, you know, Gary, here's the thing you said earlier, and people that are listening, if you ever get involved in anything like this, you pick up the phone and you call the law office, the Gallagher Law Office, because sooner or later we're going to reach out and we're going to need you to kind of do this thing. And you said earlier it's a matter kind of a family. But the other thing that you said, and people really have to relate to this that are listening to our show today, is that quite often the effects of this stuff happens decades after a guy worked with it. Mm-hmm. And that is the part that must be really hard to roll back the hands of time, because a lot of the people who work with that guy probably aren't around anymore.
Oh, no, that's exactly right. And as we move along, people get older and they pass away, like our Pearl Harbor Naval Shipyard workers who were exposed to the heaviest doses in the 40s and 50s. They're getting harder to find. They're getting harder to find.
You know, interesting you say that, because I remember there's a story about the shipyard. There's a really neat book that's come out. My friend, the late Bill Bigelow, was part of the book. And you're right on the money, because these guys prided themselves in quick turnarounds of getting something in there and fixing it and staying up all night and doing whatever they got to do. Well, these are the very people you're talking about that years later have side effects of all those great jobs they did for our country, but nobody's taking care of them unless they get up somehow and do it themselves.
We're fortunate in that we represent wonderful people. It's tragic when they're afflicted by these asbestos-related diseases, but the good news is the vast majority of the workers are not. Mm-hmm. And it's individual differences, and two guys can work side by side and breathe the same amount of dust, and one guy gets sick of the dog, and the other
guy
not.
And isn't it true? How many people we've known that have left the planet from lung cancer, and maybe somebody smoked just as much right next to them, have lungs like a baby. You know, who knows?
No, the research keeps unfolding. There's genetic components, there's complexities. But the truth of the matter is there's a lot of just randomness when it comes to medicine and causation. Causation is really tricky, and we have wonderful doctors in this town that have helped us with our clients. Very, very good doctors, pathologists and pulmonologists, internists, and very sophisticated medicine.
Specialists.
Exactly.
Specialists dealing with specialists. Here's the thing that I really think is terrific, and you can explain this, because there's, in my opinion, what little I know of what you do, and I'm learning more, and I'll be a good student on this, is that let's say that you're working with a person that is the injured party, somebody that is alive, that has been affected, that has a problem because of where he was working or where she was working, and there's a product to blame. Okay, that's one guy. But what about the guy that's dead? And now his family, who lost a father, a husband, a brother, a lover, 15 or 20 years before he should have probably died. What kind of a different spin are those cases? Whether it's I'm the injured party or I'm the family of a departed person.
They're a lot more challenging, because we don't have the person to talk to directly. So we have to dig a lot more. And, you know, we get Social Security printouts, we get work records, we get military records, we get medical records. And if they're in the Navy, you can generally find coworkers for ship lists. Other cases where we find more and more cases where we have exposures that were at various plantations, mm-hmm. the boilers, in construction sites where there was AC or asbestos-containing concrete water pipe, transite pipe was put all over this island, as well as Maui and others. So the guys who were in the trenches cutting those were exposed to a lot of asbestos.
I, from what I understand, a lot of the procedures that happen today in construction, in remodels and additions and home rebuilds, comes through things that happen as a result of the work that you've done, where when you find something, there are certain ways that it has to be dealt with. There's no option. You either seal it in or get it out. But this stuff, to me, it looks like it's going to go on harming people for a long time.
Oh, no, it's in place. You know, whether it's in powerhouses, whether it's in the ground, or whether it's in boats and canoes. Mm-hmm. It's amazing the uses that we find out, and the uses are usually discovered when we find a unique case. Now, what's interesting or helps us or allows this to happen is mesothelioma is a tumor of the outside of the lung, the lining of the lung.
The outside.
Not the inside. Okay. And it's like the outside of the lung has like two tissues. It's like saran wrap. It allows the lung to move inside the chest wall. One is a parietal pleura and one is a parenchymal pleura. And they're like saran wrap that are slippery. That's where the tumor starts. And the asbestos migrates through the lungs and actually goes out there. It can go physically out there mechanically, or it can go through the lymph nodes, another way to migrate. But it's that mechanical movement of the fiber that's like a little invisible needle that starts the tumor.
You know, I just had this thought. What about the poor guy that did this and worked in that profession for 30 years and at the same time smoked a pack and a half of cigarettes a day?
Well, it depends. Lung cancer, there is a connection, mm-hmm. and it can be synergistic, meaning if you smoke, if you exposed to asbestos, you might have 4 or 5 times the risk of getting lung cancer. But if you also smoked, it can go up to 50 or even to 95 times higher, depending on the study.
Well, we talked a couple times off the air about this part of it, and that is your involvement as the attorney for the state of Hawaii in the tobacco settlement. And I know that all of these things that go through our respiratory system are somehow interactive with each other. Talk just for a minute. I want to get back to this actual case study to make sure we have time to deal with that a little bit today. But also talk about maybe the kind of work and background and historical gathering had to be to state Hawaii's case in the tobacco settlement.
Well, it was very complex from the standpoint that the State Department of Health and HMSA have records and data, and we had to go through those and recognize all of the tobacco-related diseases and what the state had to pay in the assistance or welfare for someone who had a lung cancer, emphysema, and all these various things that the state actually had to foot the bill for and can be, in fact, epidemiologically traced back. And that was an extremely costly and time-consuming project that involved a lot of high-level science.
And I don't guess it's ever really going to be settled. I mean, there's no way to, I guess, recoup financially or emotionally or any other way the things caused by that, you know, by that habit. But I'm guessing that it is indicative once you can admit fault. Say, for instance, recently we've seen there's this huge settlement by oil companies for certain things, for pollution, for a boat that leaks into a harbor. Did that used to happen? I mean, doesn't it happen now because there are people that specialize in liability?
Oh, exactly. And now, all of these are policy-driven. We look at the court decisions, meaning they're trying to make the world safer for us. Mm-hmm. We can never make it perfectly safe. It would be prohibitively costly, but we can certainly make huge changes. So, you know, we don't have machines with unguarded blades on them. We don't. We have airbags in our cars. We have wonderful things that are going to help us out in the long run, and primarily because of litigation over the years, it's gotten stronger. And whether it's asbestos, whether it's tobacco, whether it's defective products, we live in a safer world now.
You know, that being said, I'm guessing that one of the things that you said in another program, and I think this it'd be a good chance to talk about it again. When we talk about the big bad company, the manufacturer, whoever is making this stuff or has been distributing this stuff for years and years, you're explaining that they have, rather than fess up to things, they have their own attorneys, and their attorneys are just to mitigate something out and settle it and get rid of it.
Well, it's a lot more complex than that. There's insurance companies and reinsurance companies that have billions of dollars at risk, and it's in their financial interest to delay things as long as they can.
What about companies that just couldn't take really fessing up, manning up for what's been done? There must be a lot of companies that no matter how bad they feel at this point in their history, they did things that are irreparable, and there's just no way to fix it financially.
Well, it still goes on today. It's amazing, but we usually try to get documents as to what the company knew and what they did. And as hideous as it sounds, a lot of these companies have actually destroyed evidence. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And unfortunately, some of that's been done with the assistance of lawyers, nationally coordinating discovery. And we've discovered some of that, and we go after that real hard.
Let's go back now and get into a little bit of a study. And folks, I want you to understand this. This program is being brought to you as a give back to the community by Gary and his firm. And we're not really trying to make the phones ring off the hook, but there are going to be times when you're going to hear something, and maybe even about this case, where you can be contributory. And if you feel like you want to, like Gary was talking about a few moments ago, if you feel like, hey, this is Ohana and this is Hawaii, and I knew this guy or I knew that guy or I might be able to help this, your contribution would be virtually priceless. And so you need to know how to get in touch with the firm. GallagherLaw.com is the easiest way. You can submit an email. Somebody will call you. It'll be anonymous. And if there ever comes a moment where you feel motivated to jump in and join in the quest, you'd be very, very welcome. So with that being said, we're working on a case right now, or you're working on a case that I've learned about that's pretty important, and it is to do with this stuff, this asbestos stuff. And it's mind-blowing what happened to this guy and how it happened.
Yeah, well, you know, Hawaii, we have such a proud history. The Hawaiians were smartest people on planet Earth and the most advanced when it came to canoe design and navigation 2,000 years ago. Mm-hmm. And it's just when you think about the eons and the countless lives that were lost to develop that technology, canoes that could sail open ocean 3,000 miles and turn around and get back in storms and everything. The technology at that time was cutting edge, the best. And the same thing with the navigation. They were the best scientists and astronomers, where the Europeans were thinking they're going to fall off the end of the world. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Hawaiians are just going back and forth, or the Polynesians. So, and today, we still celebrate that and have great pride, and rightfully so. But part of it is the paddling community, mm-hmm. and that works so hard, and just it's just fabulous. And in that community, there's various people that, you know, have raced Molokai how many times, and Tommy Connor was one. Mm-hmm. And it was sad that we lost him at only age 68, and he died of mesothelioma.
You know, let me tell those that don't know just a little bit about Tommy and why this is so prophetic, because we're talking about the voyage of discovery right now, the Hikianalia and the Hokulea going around the world, showing our navigational skills. But the material these boats are made out of are what killed this guy. And interestingly enough, Tommy Connor, outside of being a father and a paddler and a coach and a builder of boats, was also a fireman. He was also a policeman. Here's a guy that was really a fountain of good things and service and community service. And what got him was, I guess, just a desire to be all things to all people in this area. Who knew? And at what point in time did you become aware of his family and his problem?
We were contacted that Tommy had mesothelioma. And it wasn't clear at first, but then the diagnosis was confirmed. And for those who don't know, mesothelioma is what they call a signal tumor, meaning when you find it, you immediately think asbestos because there's nothing else that causes it.
Isn't that incredibly?
It's you when you when the original epidemiology was put together, you round up everybody have the disease, and almost everybody worked around asbestos. And the spooky part is it doesn't take much. Mm-hmm. There's children of shipyard workers who just the shipyard worker brings the dust home and the clothes. The wife does the laundry. We have a plantation case on Kauai where the wife got mesothelioma while her husband was both at the same time. Where she did his laundry.
Because, as you explained, maybe his genes were going to reject it, and his wife's genes weren't.
But in his case, they both got it. Uh-huh. It was just really tragic. Whereas, so when once we got the mesothelioma, it becomes a detective story. Mm-hmm. And this is one we're still looking. From the standpoint that one of these companies denied they ever even sold the product, which is mm-hmm. ridiculous, oh, because we have documents to show in the buyer's guide they're bragging about selling it, come down and buy it from us. Yeah. And that particular company repackaged it, took it out of the 50-pound bags and put it in quart and gallon bags with no label, no just asbestos. I was living on the North Shore as a surfer and teaching school in Haleiwa, and Jose Angel and myself and Jeff Johnson built a boat. And we ourselves bought it, the asbestos from Fiberglass Hawaii way back then, and it was used as a putty. If you put two pieces of plywood together in a boat and there was a big gap, you would mix it with resin, laminating resin and catalyst, and put it in there like a spackle with a putty knife, and it would be nice and smooth, and you'd gloss over it.
I can hear, I can see and feel people in listening audience right now that are wiping their arms and their stomachs, because I remember what you remembered as a boat builder, and certainly what I did, fixing dings in boats and surfboards of my own, because it's easy. You go down to Fiberglass Hawaii or wherever, and you buy your mat, your roving, and everything else. But while you continue on that thought, make sure that people understand the difference, Gary, between asbestos and fiberglass.
Okay, now it's huge. Now, fiberglass is what we know. It's put together, and we use it for boats and surfboards. And we mix the resin and catalyst, and it gets hard, and you shape it and mold it and whatever. But with respect to health, there's no comparison mm-hmm. from the standpoint that while fiberglass is itchy and you really don't like to work with it and grind it, and that was Jose's job in my circumstance, it's the asbestos that causes mm-hmm. the disease.
When did the two products get married to each other? Or used with each other, I should say.
In the 60s and 70s, I know Amfac and Fiberglass Hawaii were selling asbestos. Amfac was selling 50-pound bags, and it was used in big catamarans that were built, you know, that 404 Piikoi complex You know, our,
I like a dollar for every boat that cranked out of that.
Kirk Clark, that was back in the, that was kind of the Wild West days. They build these boats so big and get them launched from there. They went and cut off parking meters early.
They had to remove power lines. They had to do all kinds of
to
things
get them down.
To get a boat from 404 Pequoy to the Alloway Harbor.
But from an industrial point of view, asbestos is almost indestructible, and it made the best putty ever. Strongest putty ever, and it's so strong that that's what the knobs or the little handles on pots and pans are made of, asbestos and thermoplastic. But the canoe builders, the boat builders, used it routinely, and we used it to repair surfboards, coping up against where you had a square joint, and we're going to make a curve. You can make that curved with this putty. And it was used, it was ubiquitous, it was all over the place, and it was super strong, and then glass would go over it.
Have your studies and these case studies that you've done in the last, say, decade on this, and maybe even going further back than that, are there a lot of people that use this material and didn't know what they were using?
Oh, exactly. I mean, even to this day, I talk to people, oh, yeah, we used that, it was great, it was fiberglass. I said, that wasn't fiberglass, not in the 60s.
Yeah.
It was asbestos. Later on, they replaced it with cabocil and other things that didn't have the asbestos. But it was used for the same thing as a thickening agent.
Wouldn't that have been almost an admission of guilt by a company that was making it that started making the same end-use product out of some other material because they knew that the first material was hurting people?
It is. It's the parlance of the law, it's called a subsequent remedial measure.
Oh, boy.
And it is. And but we go back and we have to trace this. So we have investigators and myself. I love to talk to people, the old-timers that know this stuff, worked with it firsthand. And amazingly, we will find workshops, oftentimes will actually have old product.
Okay, let's take this guy that we're talking about today. And he had a plethora of jobs. I mean, this guy, he tried everything. He was a very, very intelligent guy. I miss him. He was a very, very nice guy. And always gave of his time to teach people in whatever area he was. But as a policeman, as a fireman, as a boat builder, canoe maker, surf ski maker, surfboard shaper, this guy probably had it coming at him from all angles.
When you look at those trades, and we've looked at them all, and there's studies on them, and then factually, there's not much in the way of asbestos exposure for firemen and policemen. Likewise, surfboard shaper, you know, you're making a lot of dust, a lot of foams flying around. On the other hand, if you're doing the repair work on boats or you're using the asbestos putty that was mixed by boat builders and actually ground and sanded, that's a different story.
How many people today, Gary Gallagher, are working on a boat and trying to repair a boat that's got rot or this or something else, and they're going in and they're grinding out old stuff to replace it with this new stuff? Aren't they asking for trouble?
It would depend. If the boat was built, you know, in the 60s or 70s, and it was a home-built kind of thing, probably custom-built. You didn't find this as much in the production boats, but there were still uses of it.
Okay.
So,
what about this? Here comes this case where this guy gets sick many, many years after working with this stuff. I want to know in the fact gathering and everything else what roadblocks there are and what scores there are. In other words, how many people have come forward so far in this case, and what are you still looking for as far as not anecdotal but stuff that somebody can really remember? I remember this day and this happened and so and so.
I mean, I'm dealing with boat builders and famous canoe builders that remember bidding in the same product. They used it just like I did, just on a bigger scale more often. And so that's what we're trying to find, the people that actually went to Fiberglass Hawaii or went to Amfact and bought the materials.
But how do you deal with somebody that said, I didn't sell that?
Well, that can be their story. That's fine, okay?
Yeah.
And then when I have that person on the stand, and here I have year after year selling Johns Manville product, and you go and there's a list in the Hawaii Buyer's Guide that lists
That's like documentation.
Yeah, that's fine. Let that be their story.
Your Honor, evidence number 13.
No, and, you know, we've had this in front of the jury before, and we know how it's going to come out. So at some point, they quit saying that.
Yeah.
But that's their initial reaction or what their initial that they filed, unfortunately for them, under oath. But we'll set the record straight.
Well, let me ask you this, because I think that what we've got here is the pebble in the pond. You mentioned the boat builders, which is obviously this, and there's lots of them. I mean, you know, we dabbled in it, but there got some guys that, you know, I know a guy that's been shaping surfboards and stuff for 40 years. And yet what I'm worried about is when you hear every now and again, Gary, you hear about a child that's crawling around a job site or a home remodel where maybe they had asbestos, these little tiles that went on the floor in the kitchen before. Like you said, really, one of the main industrial uses of that stuff, it was used in these tiles.
We had a case not too much different. The tiles on that, when they're just sitting there doing nothing, there's not a problem. But when they're getting cut, when they're getting removed, when they're getting sanded, then it's a big problem. But we had a case very close to that where on Maui recently, the victim was only 50 years old, and her exposure was her dad's business where he repaired pumps that went into sewage treatment plants on Maui. And as kids, there would be toddlers around, and the dad was changing gaskets and packing in the garage, and they were right there. That was just part of the deal. Mm-hmm. So, yes, that's how they were exposed. So whenever you find one of these mesotheliomas, it's a detective story. Mm-hmm. And we solve them, and it's with the help of witnesses that come forward.
Yeah, I think but the fact gathering to me is, and we talked about this a little bit a while ago, that it used to be a lot of, and I guess this is true in any part of law, a lot of, you know, it's not all glamorous in the courtroom, Your Honor, this is evidence. Somebody's got to actually do the, you know, planting the seed and sowing the crops and doing the research and talking to people.
Oh, no, we do that, and it's at every level from medical research. We don't bring a case unless we can prove every single point of it.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that, Gary. Back in the day, when somebody comes to GallagherLaw.com now and says, you know, I've heard good things. I see stuff in the paper. I know what a successful career you've had. I got a problem. I want to know how to deal with it. How do you choose cases?
Now, we have criteria, and we go through. It's usually we have to show, like, for instance, in a defective product, we have to show that they actually use the product, how, where, and when. Most times, you just can't take someone's recollection. It could be faulty unless they were really with it for a long, long time. But we always find corroboration.
You know, you sometimes hear on these shows that we talked about a while ago, well, the precedent was set here and the precedent was set there. You have had so many successful pursuits in this area. How important is that? Here in Hawaii, for instance, if you can make my case be parallel with the case that's already been solved, is that the deal maker?
Well, generally, yes, but the law can change, and judges can change. And, you know, we had law established for almost 30 years in state court, and there's been some changes in federal court. So we have to go back and reevaluate and maybe take it to a higher standard that we might not agree with, but that's what the court's ruling. That's what we'll do.
Some of these companies that you've mentioned, and I can remember, you mentioned, we talked about the 404 PE Koi complex. There were a lot of entrepreneurs and guys that were great craftsmen but lousy businessmen, so they go out of business, they fall apart. Has that been also the case in some of these pretty good-sized manufacturers of things that turned out hurting people? Did they go away?
Yes and no. Some did not adapt with the technology. For instance, in the original days, the companies that had the vertical monopolies, they didn't want to change. They just denied that asbestos caused these diseases. Mm-hmm. And when they did experiments on animals, it wasn't out of the goodness of their heart. They were trying to defend cases being brought against them. And instead of getting their product exonerated, it got indicted with cancer and it got worse. And they were so low life as they buried that research. Well, we found it. Well, when the jury sees that, that's not very helpful to them.
Do people ever ask you today, these family members of people that have suffered from this affliction, are they still mining asbestos? Is it still being used? Have they learned anything? Is it used more safely than it used to be? Where is this stuff these days?
The use has greatly been curtailed in the United States, but it's mind-boggling. the political influences of the mining concerns in Canada still try to use it, and they still do successfully and export it. In India and these other countries, it's sad they're still being utilized.
Well, let's talk about this. I mean, obviously, every now and again, and I want people to understand that sometimes they'll hear the term frivolous lawsuit. That's going to get thrown out as frivolous. I'm wondering if how much of this material goes to parts of the world, like you said, India or China, and comes back into the United States, and there's gases coming off it, and there's toxic stuff in it. Isn't this like a smorgasbord? I mean, a potential liability?
Well, it is. In fact, we just discovered that in a case we litigated 2 years ago, where our client worked around transmissions, and the transmission paper in it had asbestos in it, and that transmission paper was sold through a Keiretsu to Japan, and it's, you know, the Toyota way. It's kind of a Zen process where the suppliers and the manufacturers all get together and design things. The product went up there, and it came back to the United States again, and the Toyota transmissions worked on right here in Honolulu. And the Japanese manufacturers objected when the company was trying to take the asbestos out of the part. They say, well, there's no government regulation, but they're saying there's thousands of people getting sick every year. So we got all those documents and traced it up and back. You hit the nail right on the head. But there they have a Keiretsu, which in the financial piece of it is not legal in the United States because it's price fixing.
Yeah, when we talked specifically about this case we're talking about today, this the late Tom Connors case, sometimes there must be, you get to a point where there's like a standstill, where the whole thing comes to a stop, and then you got to roll up your sleeves, use your expertise, get your team going, and go back off in a direction. Has that happened, or does it happen regularly, and is it happening in this particular case?
It is, from the standpoint that there's complexities that have to do with insurance. Most of these claims are covered by insurance, and we have to dig into that depending on the right years. And oftentimes, companies have lost their insurance policies, and there's a whole big discovery effort goes forward on that to take care of these families that need to be compensated.
Okay, now in this particular case, I know, because I was talking to some of your associates about it, and when we're talking in general terms without specific names or anything like that, there are people that are coming out of the woodwork that remember things. And you said before, I mean, how incriminating would it be if I had a catalog for my old company listing a product that I later said that I didn't sell? And, well, you really, here's a catalog. Somebody must have sold some of it because it was in your catalog.
It's interesting that someone superficially might originally say that, but once we do the digging, that fairy tale goes away. And that's exactly what will happen. If you really want to tell that to your jury, really?
Yeah.
I mean, and they won't. They don't. And the cases like that, once we get them worked up, settled generally.
You know, every now and again you'll see the Home and Garden TV station, they show you a house getting flipped. And in a weekend, this whole new place gets built up. And I do know that's probably the first thing out of a potential client's mouth in any practice of law has to be, how much is it and how fast is it going to be? What sort of you're an A personality. I mean, you probably don't like waiting a whole bunch of time for stuff, but isn't that a really big part of what you do? You really have to have your nose to the grindstone, and it takes a while.
Depending on the case, and we have a half a dozen or a dozen companies nationally that never want to see us in a courtroom again. And we negotiate with them privately on an individual case. And that really, really helps our families out and our clients. If someone doesn't have long to live and they get their affairs in order, and that happens routinely. On the other ones, the other extreme, I've had cases reversed on appeal, had to try it again three times. We just resolved the matter with Travelers Insurance Company, or in the process of involving it, we were involved in for 15 years.
Oh, my.
15 years.
Oh, I would have been pulling my hair out.
Oh, I used to be young and skinny and handsome, too.
But see, what I think is important is, and I think that you could really give families a feeling of, wait a minute, somebody can help me here. And I think, Gary, that I need to know, and I have no clue, and you've been, you know, decades of this, what sort of a way do you value what happened to somebody, what it cost them, how much to ask for in damages, and is there ever real justice? I mean, how can you say, how much is a life worth? If somebody dies at 50 that should have been to 70, do you figure out how much they would have made in 20 more years? I mean, how do you determine what's what?
And there's different components to that, and juries are very good at it, quite frankly. And
are judges good at it?
Judges generally judge the law and let the jury judge the facts. Okay. Sometimes judges will make the determination on damages, and generally they're fine too.
Mm-hmm. I know that it probably doesn't get any easier when you're dealing with families, because they're all in a state of pretty of grief and sorrow and all of these kind of things. But at the end of the trail, when settlement is reached or when something does come up, what sort of gratification is there to families and stuff? Is there ever an end to this stuff, or does anybody really win?
We can never replace someone their actual loss. We can just approximate what the law does. Mm-hmm. But it really does help when there is a recognition. And once the families get involved with us and they understand some of the liability, where some of these companies were just grossly negligent or reckless, and then here's somebody, you know, is not coming back, that it seems like there's a sense of justice, especially when the purpose is to make sure this doesn't happen again. Or these companies are going to learn a lesson, and the holy mackerel, we want to be putting this stuff in here, Laura. We need to test this beforehand. So the policy, once the individual plaintiffs and their family members as survivors understand it, are generally very happy with that. Or at least they're serving some
purpose. In a sense, like closure as well.
Exactly.
You got to feel good. And, you know, I want to talk about that again, because I do know there's some specific things that you're looking at. But I think that people can really sort of relate to some other things that go on, and that is in the big picture, you know, how we accept responsibility for that we've done as a company or whatnot. We talk about hearing these people that they call whistleblowers. I would imagine whistleblowers are really valuable to attorneys that need to get facts on companies that are sweeping stuff under the rug.
Oh, they're critically important. And there's a tremendous amount of pressure to not be a whistleblower. Mm-hmm. Your job, your career, your reputation in that particular. But it gets to the point that some people just say, I'm not going to do that. And then when you find that person and you talk to that person, they'll frequently say, I knew somebody was going to call me one day on this. And at the end of the day, we've represented a number of whistleblowers as well on big matters. And they're brave, very brave. And they always are doing it for the right reason.
We've seen a huge big thing right now about this manufacturer, a certain company in Japan that manufactures airbags. And this thing has grown exponentially. Isn't that sort of typical what happens when one story comes out, somebody says, hey, you know what, that happened to my friend across the street. His thing blew up and it broke his jaw, and they told him, they gave him $5,000, told him, you know, don't worry about it.
Frequently, it's a pattern that emerges, and it's been my experience that every case I have handled, that once you find a defect in a product, mm-hmm. it wasn't the Lone Ranger.
Yeah, okay.
There's history on that. And frequently, it's the manufacturer knew about it, but rather than fix it because it was going to cost more or redesign or reapproval, they just slide it to the side and hope for the best, and then the consumers pay the price.
I was dying to ask you from last week, and somebody at the grocery store asked me this too, because, you know, right now on primetime television at night, you watch this, just this huge myriad of ads about medicines that's going to help you. And it tells you in the very beginning, this stuff takes care of this. And then 30 seconds, how you're going to have suicidal thoughts and bad dreams and nausea. It seems to me like a lot of those guys and a lot of those companies are setting themselves up to say, look, we think we have a pretty good product here, but it could kill you. Are they covering themselves with these waivers or these disclaimers?
They're trying.
Yeah.
But that, what it really comes back to is Big Pharma has huge, huge money. And huge, huge influence on what we think and what we want. You're reading the ad, and you half the time with the new products or more, it's the consumer who's seen the ad that goes ask the doctor for it.
Sure.
The doctor's not coming out of the blue and recommending this. And Big Pharma has all of the information. And that's why it's really important that we have government regulators that really force the disclosure. Unfortunately, there's a lot of money there, and oftentimes scientists will have a stake in it on how much is marketed. But Big Pharma knows exactly how to generate sales on any product if they decide to do it.
You're so accurate on that, because I saw there's this one company, and without naming it, they have a certain bunch of ads on TV. And at the end of the ad, it always says, okay, this is wonderful stuff. It's going to make you lose weight. It might kill you. You might have bad dreams, suicidal thoughts. And if you don't have enough money, we might be able to help you get the stuff. And I mean, they're just laying it all down.
They're just pushing their finger on the scale, making it come their way. Yeah. That's just
now,
how they do it.
Now, how, though, do you let a family know or somebody know that, look, don't be intimidated by this thing. It's going to take a while, but here's what we need to do. Let's talk about how that happens when you decide. I mean, this is a huge area of personal injury and product liability, isn't it, this whole new medicine thing?
Well, no, it is, and they're very difficult, expensive cases to litigate, and the Big Pharma definitely has the advantage in those cases. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, the judicial system, MDLs or multi-district litigation, sends these cases to one place, maybe on the East Coast, New Jersey or Philadelphia, and it makes it really, really hard. And rather than a case be individually evaluated and determined like it should be, they're either done in a mass fashion. Mm-hmm. There might be a few lead trials, and it's not the real justice that we'd like to see.
Okay, and I'm telling you, at GallagherLaw.com, you're going to find out about some of these things, these landmark cases, if you will, whether it be tobacco settlement or the asbestos issue. But getting into what makes it a part of the team and why you should get interested in this, only because I think that you've just refused to take no. I mean, you and your team, if you do take a case, it's with reasonable certainty that you going to put the screws down and find out what's going on in this thing. How can people help?
We really do our homework, and we try to be really objective. We know the pitfalls, the problems, and what kind of battles we're going to have ahead. We anticipate those and really do our homework. We reach out to experts, consultants, and figure out, and we'll do a lot of research way before we file anything. And we're in a pretty good a position to recommend, and oftentimes, you know, we'll tell a client, we've worked really hard, we looked at this, and this is what it is, and we cannot proceed because of this. On the other hand, once we do have our ducks lined up, even though there's risk involved, we fully disclose those risks and say, we're fine with this. We're taking this as, you know, we've got 25 people to be working on your case and going forward, but we have a, you know, pretty good idea what the issues are, and we think they stack up well for our client. And if we feel that there's really injustice done, there's a way to prove something was defective and that defect caused the problem, we're all over it.
You know, we see law firms, mainland law firms, farming here in Hawaii a lot on certain things, whether they be a hip replacement or this or that, and it's these big, big deals going on. I think that we should, as a parting shot today, let people know that you and Gallagher Law have cases all over the country based on exporting success from Hawaii to the mainland, where usually it's the other way around. We're waiting for guys to come in from the mainland and tell us what to do and how to get paid.
No, we have a lot of these ads you see on TV, you know, for the mesothelioma cases. I get calls from lawyers all over the country. Hey, Gary, can you help me with the case? Mm-hmm. Well, where's the person live? Well, they live in Waimanalo. Oh, well,
yeah.
Okay. You know,
but
we want to do a good job with the client, and we figure something out. On the other hand, on several things, whether it was the boiler company defrauding the court, with their national coordinating counsel that ended up in the Traveler's Resolution, or others were investigating, or the defective respirators, were asked to screen cases and get involved with other law firms across the United States.
I want some of your air miles. I mean, you guys have been putting on some serious air miles for a while, and I know that that's got to be not just gratifying, but somehow letting your people and yourself bask in the success part of it, because there's an awful lot of minutiae. It sounds to me like you guys got to grind and grind and grind. How many of these cases actually go to trial?
Once we fully worked up our cases, 99% of them settle.
Yeah.
Now,
it's the smart path for the person, the liable person to take, isn't it?
Well, it's, you know, they bring in the smartest lawyers in America, and we're fine with that. Mm-hmm. The last two times we've we started trials year after year, and they settle, and they usually come to our numbers and resolution. But, you know, the last two cases have gone to verdict. The talented trial team from America, I mean, from somewhere else, won in their national counsel, offered $40,000, and the jury came in with $5.3 million in federal court and a state court. And that guy was divorced, so they thought they could really give it a lowball number in Hawaii.
Yeah, you know, they might say something like, well, you guys all wear slippers over there. I don't even know what's going on. I think that isn't it because maybe this wonderful thing called the shipyard really sort of opened, you know, the opportunity to make things right for people, because there was so much that went on there. I'm not saying it's a great place, but it certainly has history.
At Pearl Harbor Naval Shipyard, they had 25,000 employees at World War II, and it went down and then back up to about 15 in the Korean War, and then stabilized around 5,000. But Hawaii is a real unique community, and it's just wonderful here as opposed to a real alienated place where people worked all over, and it's just real, real different.
Well, here we are again at the end of another program, Gary. Great hooking up with you again today. And folks, you want to know more about what's going on? Take a minute now that you've listened to the program. Come back again and listen next week. But also go to GallagherLaw.com, G-A-L-I-H-E-R, GallagherLaw.com. See you next time.
Well, that's our program for today, and we certainly hope you'll come back next week for our next episode. In the meanwhile, to learn more about Team Gallagher, log on to GallagherLaw.com. That's G-A-L-I-H-E-R, law.com.